Tools are not only used by humans. Ground squirrels kick sand in the face of venomous snakes, and apes do all kinds of things utilizing tools. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, we listen back to a program from June of last year. Ben Kiefer talks with the authors of the revision of the seminal book, Animal Tool Behavior. His guests are Ben Beck, the former conservation director at the Great Ape Trust, Rob Shoemaker of the Indianapolis Zoo, and Christina Walkup of Drake University. Coming up after the news.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us for this encore edition of the program. We want to spend the hour talking about tool use by non-human animals, what it indicates about intelligence, and how the use of tools fits into evolution, for example. Our guests are the authors of the long-awaited revision of the seminal book, Animal Tool Behavior. When first published in 1980, Benjamin Beck's Animal Tool Behavior was the first volume to catalog and to analyze the complete literature on tool use and manufacture in non-human animals. His work inspired, it energized legions of researchers to study the use of tools by a variety of species. Now, in a revised and updated edition of this landmark publication, Robert Shoemaker and Christina Walkup have joined Beck to reveal the current state of knowledge regarding animal tool behavior. All three of them join us for the hour. Dr. Ben Beck is director of conservation at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. He joins us by phone. Dr. Beck, welcome.
I'm here.
Very good. Do you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, Ben, welcome.
Very nice to be with you.
Welcome to the show, Ben. Also joining us by phone, Christina Walkup, adjunct assistant professor at Drake University. You're there as well, Christina.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Very good. Glad to have you on board. And joining us, I assume from Indianapolis, Dr. Rob Shoemaker, vice president of life sciences at the Indianapolis Zoo. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Ben.
Let's reach out to our listeners as well, because we hope this will be a very interactive hour with our listeners with questions about animal tool behavior. Have you observed animals in the wild, perhaps in your home, using tools? Tell us your story, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Ben, let's please start with you. This book was written 30 years ago, and since then, there's been an explosion of research into animal tool behavior. You cited in that first edition 600 sources, 1,750 sources in this revised edition. Why so much attention paid to this topic?
Well, we'd like to believe that the first edition was just so exciting that it drove a number of people to study this interesting topic. But the truth is, it is a fascinating topic. It's been on the minds of animal behaviorists for at least 150 years. And I think the interest in field studies, in studying animals in their natural environment and also in the laboratory, and a lot more interest in the mental lives of animals has really triggered this explosion of interest.
In 1980, when you first had this book come out, did you have any idea that this would be a trigger for so much research, so much inspiration, also to Christina and Rob, as we'll find out as well?
I didn't see it that way. I really saw it as trying to put together some compendium or encyclopedia of what had already been done, and quite frankly, was not looking at the book as a stepping stone for future development.
Let's start perhaps by having you, Ben, define tool use. You do a great job of helping readers get into this mindset for considering what is or isn't tool use. With a list that begins on the first page of the first chapter, you use 53 separate examples and ask the reader to decide whether each one is or is not a tool use. Would you mind giving us some examples for us to consider?
I'd love to do that, and this is always great fun and sometimes maddening, and it'll be interesting to hear what our listeners have to say about this today. But one of my favorite examples is monkeys or apes pounding nuts, pounding opening nuts by by pounding them with a stone. So they use a stone as a hammer, they put the nut on a hard surface, and they pound the nut with a stone and break through the shell. That's clearly tool use. Everybody would agree that that's tool use. But then we have a herring gull, a seagull, that opens shellfish by dropping it from a from some altitude onto a stone surface. So is he using that seawall or that parking lot, that stone surface, as a tool?
Well, the tone of your question makes me think perhaps not, because there's no that is part of the land. There is no sort of intervening object he is using.
Exactly. I think we're going to have to invoke the requirement that a tool has to somehow be held or carried while it's being used. It has to be portable in a way.
Okay.
You agree?
Yes. Okay. Okay. I'll tuck that away as a guideline. What else?
Well, now don't be so rapid. Don't be so quick to accept that, Ben, because now you've just eliminated birds' nests as tools.
Oh.
Are you happy with that?
I guess I'm not too altogether happy, no.
Well, that's exactly the issues that we're confronting here, that inevitably, no matter how precisely we try to define a tool, that there's always a few cases that just don't fall into place intuitively. And a bird's nest is one that people often point out. Here's this very elaborate object that a bird uses to raise its young, and we're saying it's not a tool.
So when you have these sort of conflicting things going on in defining a tool, what is the definition? What are the guidelines, the criteria you end up using?
I would say in the end we end up using common sense, because we don't want to have a definition that is so broad and so inclusive as to not be meaningful. So, for example, if we include a bird's nest, then we have to include the tree that the squirrel climbs up to get a nut, or we have to include the building that we're in right now to give us shelter. And before you know it, we've excluded tools as a meaningful behavioral category, and we've gotten so far away from that category that I think everybody would agree. We can't say that a building is a tool for us to live in.
So we've talked a little bit about tool use. How is that different than tool manufacture?
A tool manufacture is very simply some sort of a modification of an object to make it be a better tool. So, for example, if I need a stick to insert into a crevice to get an insect, maybe I want to subtract little side branches from that stick in order to make it easier to insert it. So that would be a modification of the tool by subtraction, and that is a form of tool manufacture.
Okay, let's get into some of the concrete examples. Your book is filled with so many fascinating ones that I'd like to get into, and perhaps we can go first of all to Christina Walkup. You concentrate on invertebrates, also fish, birds. Let's start with invertebrates. What's your favorite example of tool use from the world of invertebrates?
I think my favorite example was published just a couple years ago. There's a species of octopus that will actually carry around coconut shells, so halves of coconut shells, and it actually carries them around, and when it's threatened, it stacks them back together and hides inside as a shelter.
Wow, that's good. That would have taken some keen observation or a long-time observation by someone, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. It's very interesting example, though. I also have there's lots of good examples with ants. So there's examples with weaver ants that actually use their own larvae as tools.
To do what?
They carry, their larvae actually secrete a silk, and that silk helps to cement their nest together. And so the workers will actually carry the larvae around and help to build the nest.
Oh, and then later they, of course, develop further the larvae into ants themselves.
Absolutely.
What about fish, Christina?
Fish, there's not too many examples, but probably the best known example is the archer fish. And archer fish will actually hold water in their mouth, and they'll spit that water out and above the surface of the water at insects that may be sitting on a nearby twig or overhanging the water.
Now, wait a minute. Ben Beck said we had to have something that was portable. That seems to be a skill, but I don't recognize what the tool is there, Christina.
The tool, so this is one of those trickier cases, but the tool is the water. And since the fish holds the water in its mouth and it directs the direction of the water by shooting it, then the water is considered to be a tool.
Okay, very good. Okay, let's move on to a good example of birds, Christina.
Birds, there's so many great examples of bird tool use, especially in the corvids, so the crows and ravens. Crows in particular are known to use different twigs and short twigs and leaves to extract insects that are maybe in a small hollow in a tree or under some bark.
Mm-hmm. And they craft these sticks into the size that they want, right?
Yes, in particular, the New Caledonian crows are known to go through a series of steps to craft a very specific tool that actually has a hook on the end of the tool. And so they actually make that hook-shaped tool to extract the insects.
Rob Shoemaker, let me go to you with primates. Of course, we associate non-human tool use most with the primates. Tell us about what's significant here and a couple examples.
Well, I think Christina's done a wonderful job of talking about some of the diversity in groups that we don't necessarily think about as tool users, but there's these wonderful examples all throughout the animal kingdom. When we get to primates, it is fair to say, though, that we see a huge surge in numbers of examples. So even though the book is not specifically about primates, that's for sure, it is accurate that a large percentage of the book is devoted to the examples that we see. So it's widespread among primates, although a lot of it, for example, in many of the types of monkeys, it could be throwing rocks to deter a predator or to deter someone who's pursuing them. It could be waving a branch as part of a threat display. So these are certainly forms of tool use, but ones that are particularly common. Where we start to see levels of sophistication that are really quite distinct and that really quite engaging is when we start talking about the great apes, and that's gorillas, chimpanzees, bonobos, and orangutans. And while all of the great apes are very accomplished tool users, we see the greatest number of examples, of course, in chimpanzees, but also in orangutans. And this can range anything from tools for attending to a small wound that an ape might have, tools for extracting food, tools for collecting food, tools sometimes for communication. The list is enormous, and I certainly couldn't recite it from memory, but the examples, there are hundreds of different examples that we find particularly in the great apes.
Now, particularly with the great apes, primates too, does it matter when we go back to an offshoot of this definition of what is and what is not a tool, does it matter if the tool use was trained? Of course, we can't train a fish to train it to use a tool, at least I don't think so. But we can train apes and monkeys to do a lot of things. Does that matter that they're being trained rather than picking it up from their own species?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by training. If in fact we address that question very specifically in the book, and we have avoided including any examples that were specifically trained. There are a large number of things that have been trained or that could be trained, but I think that artificially inflates the examples that we would talk about. But I want to be quick to say, again, it depends on what you mean by training. So if, for example, one ape learns a type of tool use by watching another ape, some might call that a form of training. I'd say that it's better described as a form of social learning. That would absolutely be included. So what we are looking for in the book are examples, first of all, that are published. This is basically every published example of animal tool use to the end of 2010. So everything in existence to the end of 2010, although undoubtedly we've probably missed something out there, but we haven't found it yet if we did. So all of those are included. Any very accurate reports from colleagues in terms of a personal communication, whether captive or wild, but ones that were specifically trained and that were essentially an artificial example of something that was being controlled by a human but being exhibited by a non-human, we did not include in the book.
Dr. Rob Shoemaker is with us, Vice President of Life Sciences at Indianapolis Zoo. Dr. Christina Walkup with us of Drake University. And Dr. Benjamin Beck, Director of Conservation at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. All three of them are authors of the newly revised edition of Animal Tool Behavior, the Use and Manufacture of Tools by Animals. And we'd like to reach out to you, our exchange listeners. What are your questions about animal tool behavior? Have you observed animals in the wild, perhaps in your own home, using tools? You might have a question about that. Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Rachel from Ames writes us an email. She writes that my dog, which she says is a year-and-a-half-old Labrador pit bull mutt, will put the end of a smaller stick into a notch on a larger log to brace it so he can get a better grip on the stick to chew on it. I am very impressed with how smart this seems. Is this considered tool use? Ben Beck.
Well, I think without further description, I'd have to say no. If the idea is that the log is a tool, we'd have to ask ourselves, is the dog holding or carrying the tool? And it sounds like it's not. If, however, it went on and used the stick, let's say to poke the woman who called you, then the stick would be a tool and it would be a manufactured tool.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow on that with one from my personal experience from my dog, a Border Collie Lab mix. She, when she wants to play fetch, and I don't want to play fetch, will go off into the brush, find perhaps a long slim, and actually look and find a part to break off, tailor it by taking off the side, so forth, into a suitable fetching stick. Is that a tool?
I would say that the dog is using that tool to facilitate a social interaction with you, Ben, and in fact, it's even manufacturing that tool. So, yes, the tool is a stick. The goal is to get you involved in a social interaction with the dog, and the dog has made the tool more suitable, so it's manufactured it. What do you think, Rob? Christina?
I should publish that quick.
We should publish that quick. You want to come out and see Lucy? She'll probably give me I'll give her a handshake. She'll give me a handshake as well.
I think that's actually a really interesting and exciting example, and I think we'd probably call it a form of, as Ben says, since it's a social interaction, we'd call it a form of baiting or enticement, that it's a way to get you closer and a way to engage you in some play behavior. So that's a pretty exciting example.
And what's interesting to me is that she's obviously observed this when I make a throwing stick for her, a fetching stick. But, of course, she imitated that but did it without any fingers or thumbs. She adapted in the manufacture.
So she didn't actually copy your behavior, but she copied the idea of your behavior.
Right, which seems to be even more impressive.
It is more impressive, and you can see, Ben, why this topic is so fascinating to everybody. Dina has a really good example of tool use by a dog in the book. You want to describe it, Christina?
Yeah, actually, it's a spaniel that is quite possessive with her toys, and she uses her Frisbee. She puts a hockey puck, which is also one of her toys, in the Frisbee, and then she uses the Frisbee to carry the hockey puck around and keep both toys away from other dogs and other people.
Because she only has one mouth.
Uh-huh. So she's using that Frisbee as a container.
Wow. And that is definitely tool use. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Very good. 1-866-780-9100 for tool use that you've observed in animals in the wild or in your home. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Dan in Mitchellville. Hi, Dan.
Yes, this involves toys, another example of a toy being used perhaps as a tool. Out on the East Coast about 20 or 25 years or so ago, I was visiting and I was at the beach and I watched a seagull swoop down onto the beach and pick up a stick of about probably a foot long and climb up vertically to, let's say, 75 or 100 feet and hovered and then dropped the stick. But instead of letting the stick strike the ground, the bird dove and caught the stick in the air still, flew back up to the original altitude, and again hovered and dropped the stick and dove and caught the stick and so on and so on and so on for somewhere around 5 minutes or I don't know how long, maybe 7 minutes. It was quite a long time, maybe 20 or more repetitions. I was wondering if that was an example of using something, a found object in the environment.
Interesting. So what's going on there? Is that an area for you, Christina?
I was just thinking that's one of those examples that does get difficult to define, and it's the play behavior. Unless there's a very clear function for the tool behavior, we excluded some of those examples because the whole function is play. So they're not altering another object with that particular tool. Would you agree, Ben and Rob?
I would agree. I'd like to ask Dave actually where he saw that, because I've seen the very, very same thing on Cape Cod in Massachusetts by herring gulls.
Very quickly, we've got a few seconds before we have to take a break, but go ahead. Yes, Dan.
Yes, well, I think that was in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and okay. I was wondering if this could be considered practice for dropping the oysters on the beach.
You're absolutely right. It could be considered practice, but I think Christina's got it. I really think the crows play with these objects, and therefore, because it's object play and not doesn't have an actual specific purpose, we probably wouldn't call it tool use. But as soon as that bird begins to drop shells on stone, then we're moving closer to tool use, but we're still not there.
Coming up after a short break, more of my conversation from last June, looking at animal tool behavior. Dr. Ben Beck is with us, director of the conservation at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. Also, Christina Walkup, adjunct assistant professor at Drake University, and Rob Shoemaker, vice president of life sciences at the Indianapolis Zoo. All three are co-authors of the long-awaited revision of the seminal book Animal Tool Behavior, which looks at the use and manufacture of tools by animals. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program, talking about all kinds of fascinating examples of tool use by animals. Ground squirrels kicking sand in the faces of venomous snakes, certain species of small rodents using a rake to access food, some small mice setting out markers to find their way home. Some of the examples in the brand new revised edition of Animal Tool Behavior, the use and manufacture of tools by animals. We're so glad to have the authors of that book with us, Dr. Ben Beck, who wrote the original seminal work in 1980, one of the co-authors, director of conservation at the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines, Dr. Christina Walkup, adjunct assistant professor at Drake University, and Dr. Rob Shoemaker, vice president of life sciences at Indianapolis Zoo. We're reaching out to our listeners in this hour to ask, what are your questions about animal tool behavior? What have you observed in the wild or in your home with the animals you live with about tool making, tool manufacture? Tell us your story, 1-866-780-9100. River to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. I want to mention here that this is interesting in having the three co-authors here represents three generations of work. Ben, you were Rob's academic advisor, I understand, and Rob, you were Christina's. So Ben, did this generational approach bring a unique perspective to the project?
Well, not only a unique perspective, Ben, but it couldn't have happened without it. For years, Rob bugged me about, Ben, you got to do a second edition, And I constantly said, well, it sounds like a great idea, but I don't have the energy. And Rob said, well, I'll help you. And so we began, and then we realized that this field had gotten so big and there were so many references that even two of us couldn't do it. And there was Christina right across the room. She and I had already worked on some writing projects, so it was an ideal partnership. And I really want to say, although we wrote different parts of the book, every one of us is responsible for every word in the book, and we interacted to resolve some of these tricky definitional issues, for example, and find consensus definitions. So it was a really interactive approach among three generations of scholars, and that's really satisfying.
Let's go back to our email here. Carver in Ames writes, we had an electric fence charger connected to a gate to keep our dog from escaping. To go through the gate, we would use a stick to move the wire which electrified the fence. Our dog picked up the exact same stick and flicked the wire away from the fence. I was so impressed that I felt really bad that after he put the stick down, the wire fell back on the fence and he ended up getting a shock. Not only does this seem to be tool use, but an example of social learning with only very limited exposure. What do we think about that? We get a good picture of what was happening there. Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, I'd jump in straight away
and
say that's a phenomenal example, and no doubt that it looks like social learning. This is always the thing that is so, in a way, so exciting but also a little frustrating is now we want to get all these examples and put them in the book, but it's just way too late. But I think that is a really exciting, really interesting example. And in fact, I think I recall that there were no examples or perhaps one example of tool use in domestic dogs in the 1980 version, and now in the revised version, we have several examples in there, but undoubtedly we're going to be hearing more and more of those. So I think this is going to be one of those really interesting areas where we find out that there's a lot more going on than has been documented, and we've probably underestimated the tool-using capabilities of dogs, certainly domestic dogs. So I think that's going to be a really bright spot that comes out of this work.
Rob Shoemaker is with us. Let's talk about a central question that you address in this book as well, tool use and whether it equates to intelligence, the degree to which it does. Now, we haven't long thought that tools have been associated with intelligence. Is that true, Ben?
Well, I'm gonna flip that one to Christina. She's our expert on that particular topic, Ben, if you don't mind.
No, that's fine. Christina, go ahead.
Thank you, Ben. Well, that's something we tackled. We tackled that in a chapter of the book where we explored different what we called myths regarding tool behavior. And so the myth being that tool behavior is equated or is always intelligent. And basically by reviewing all the different types of tool behavior, there are numerous examples, particularly in the invertebrates, with the insects, in which there's no necessary correlation to intelligence. And in fact, in many cases, there doesn't seem to be any learning that's required for the behavior to be performed by the animal. And so we ended up all agreeing that it's a myth. But in fact, the more sophisticated behaviors, combining different tools to make a more complex tool, using one tool to alter another tool, that those type of behaviors we do find in the great apes. And so that would be associated with more cognitively sophisticated animals.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm getting you right, it can be a sign of intelligence, certainly because half your book is dedicated to the primates, and we know they are extremely intelligent. It's then no coincidence that they use a lot of tools, but it doesn't have to mean that there's an intelligence at the other end of that, right?
Exactly, and we really emphasize that we shouldn't be defining tool use by whether it's intelligent or not. That shouldn't be part of the definition.
Okay, good point. Let's go to our next caller, 1-866-780-9100. Examples that you have observed, witnessed in the wild or perhaps at home among your animals that you have in your wild kingdom. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. John is joining us from Fairfield. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. We naturally talk about higher animals like dogs as being intelligent, using tools, etc., almost as being conscious. Now, are animals conscious? Don't they act entirely by instinct?
Interesting point. We get into consciousness. I don't know if this takes us far off of our topic or if we want to include that in this. Can I toss that to you, Ben Beck?
Sure. And John, thanks for that question. It's a great one. But it's very, very difficult to demonstrate consciousness in an animal that can't talk to us. And so we decided for purposes of definition of tool use that we'd simply duck that question and not deal with it. There's no question in my mind, at least, that many animals are conscious of some of their behaviors. And there's equally no question in my mind that many animals behave as automatons without any evidence of consciousness. But it's really difficult to scientifically demonstrate that. So we simply, in the interest of scientific rigor, we simply duck that question and we treat tool use without regard to whether it's conscious or not.
Mm-hmm. On a related point, you know, just considering the 30 years that have passed since this first edition that you brought out, Ben Beck, and the way in which the field has grown, the number of researchers, the amount of interest in this field, the fact that we know so much more about non-human tool use and its manufacture by non-humans, the tools, should that change our relationship with animals? Should we reconsider things about animals because we know so much more about we are more sophisticated in our knowledge of them? Should we reconsider our carnivorous diets, for example?
Well, there is no question, Ben, as we continue to explore the lives of animals, especially the mental lives of animals, we find fewer and fewer aspects that are unique to people. We can find examples of animals doing just about everything that people do. And that is a sobering thought, that there isn't this dualism between people and all other animals, at least with regard to their behavior. Because once we come to that recognition, I think it changes our whole sense of how we exploit animals and how we treat them. And it also, I think, changes our sense of our place in the universe and our responsibility to preserve the natural world.
Mm-hmm. And the conservation of the great apes, Rob, for instance, as well.
I couldn't agree more strongly with that, and I think, Ben, you've summarized it perfectly. You know, if I fast forward a little bit in that conversation and think of orangutans as an example, we know that tying these two concepts together, we know that tool use can vary tremendously among different populations of orangutans in the wild. And that's frequently associated with populations that are isolated from each other, either naturally, such as a river, that prevents them from mingling, or artificially with something like habitat destruction that creates islands of habitats. What we know is there are literally different cultures that exist in the wild for orangutans, certainly there for chimpanzees. So when we talk about conservation and we think about behaviors like tool use, of course it's important to conserve the species and care about the species, but there's also this other layer in there that you have to consider, are you preserving all of the different cultures that exist? Because all orangutans in the wild are not the same, just like all people are not the same. So I think it really becomes a much more complex equation when you start thinking about the behaviors and the cultural aspects that have been documented that we know are there. So it's really no longer a question just about species preservation. It's a question about preservation of different cultures at the same time.
Rob Shoemaker with us, Christina Walkup and Ben Beck, co-authors of the new revised edition of Animal Tool Behavior, the Use and Manufacture of Tools by Animals. Don is in Woodward on the phone. Don, welcome to our program.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call. In light of full disclosure, I'm a practicing anthropologist, so I have some background in your discussion. What I'd like the folks to talk about today is the seminal work of Dr. Jill Preece from Iowa State. She has really helped rewrite the book on primate tool use. In the early days, it was Jane Goodall. She passed the baton on to the late Diane Fossey, and now the person carrying that baton right now, from my perspective, is Dr. Jill Preece from Iowa State. So if you could talk about Dr. Jill Preece's work, I'd appreciate that.
Jill Preece has been a guest on this show a number of times. Who can talk about her? Rob, would you be someone who can tell us, remind us what about her work?
Well, I'll start, but I know Christina will want to jump in on this too. Sure. I think probably the main... Jill Preece studies chimpanzees in Senegal at a site called Fongoli. And what's actually, I think, to me, the most interesting aspect of her work that has come out is finding that chimpanzees there used tools that they actually modified to have sharp ends when they were trying to capture small mammals to eat, little bush babies. Some folks are comfortable calling those spears. Some folks are not comfortable calling those spears. The photographs I've seen of them sure looks like a spear to me. So I don't think getting hung up on the vocabulary is such a big deal, but it's a very interesting and very influential finding. And I think it nicely fits into this idea of variation among populations. The Senegal population lives in a very challenging environment, very hot and very dry, with not a huge amount of forest cover by any means. And as a result, I think they are using techniques and tools that are not seen in other areas. I would hesitate, however, even though Jill is a friend and a colleague and I respect her tremendously, I would hesitate to say that this redefines chimpanzee tool use. If we go back in literature and look in the early 1900s, work by Curler with chimpanzees in captivity, it was documented then, more than 100 years ago. So I think it says a lot about chimpanzee adaptability and a lot about chimpanzee variation. But maybe I'll let Christina jump in and continue on from there.
Yeah, our time's running short. Christina, a brief comment, if you could.
Oh, I guess Rob summarized that great. So I was just going to add that it's another example of something shared between humans and chimpanzees, that both humans and chimpanzees are using sticks to hunt animals. Mm. And that was certainly an amazing discovery.
John is joining us from Des Moines.
Well, thank you very much. An observation several years ago of a mockingbird foraging in our backyard where it was using its wings and holding them out in such a way as to shade a portion of the ground immediately in front of its body. And then it would apparently be feeding on insects that either were activated or somehow easier to see by virtue of the wings being raised.
Mm.
And it did that for about 20 minutes. And I was quite intrigued to understand whether that would qualify as the use of a tool if it's really an animal using a part of their body in that means.
Ben Beck, does that work to use a part of your body? Can you call that a tool?
I'm afraid not. And, John, you really put your finger on it to make a very bad pun, and that is if you were to use your finger to let's say, squash an ant, are you using your finger as a tool? Is your tooth a tool to chew on a piece of meat? Probably not. In other words, if we start to introduce body parts as tools, we're taking our definition, we're broadening it so far as to make it somewhat meaningless. So we would say body parts can't be tools.
John, thank you for that call from Des Moines.
You're welcome.
And coming up on the end of the program, I wanted to spin this out into the future. What we think we'll discover about animal tool behavior is a place to go to. But you have this quote in the book that I wanted to get you to react to, and it is as follows. The unprecedented impact of technology on the biological and physical environment and the uncertainty of continued energy sources to support technological endeavor have led many to predict the extinction of the human lifestyle, the species, or even the planet. In a final irony, tool behavior would not only be stripped of its role as a primary shaper of our species, but would also be recast as the progenitor of the engine of our destruction. Ben, can you...
Well, I'm responsible for that one. But, you know, the one thing that so far has held up as a distinction between the human animal and all other animals in their tool use is that we power some of our tools with fossil fuels. And no other animal, to our knowledge, does that. No other animal uses wind either to power their tools. All animal tool use that we've been able to discover, the animals are using either gravity or their own metabolism. So humans are unique, at least so far, in using wind and fossil fuels. And when you start to use fossil fuels, what we're talking about now is technology as opposed to tools.
I'm wondering, go ahead.
And that's what makes human tool use unique, is that it's technological. And, of course, technology is viewed by many as being one of those forces that threaten the environment that we live in.
I can only imagine that the new revision of this book will spark a lot of interest, and we've just seen in the last few years with our new tool, this great new tool we have called the Internet, that people love to watch non-human species using tools, doing fascinating things on the web. Do you ever discover things, Christina, watching YouTube and seeing animals out there? Is this a way to discover things you didn't know about animals?
I think it is a way to discover things, but it's something we avoided in the book. We really had to stick to published accounts or accounts from scientific colleagues. So we avoided just going on YouTube and searching out some of these really interesting accounts just to maintain the scientific validity of our book.
Dr. Ben Beck, with a minute or so remaining, spin this out into the future for us. Where does our research in animal tool behavior go from here? What do you see as trends?
I think Rob talked about this idea of traditions that are specific to certain groups of animals, and that is a question which I think many scientists are really interested in, what we call population-specific differences in behavior or traditions. It's like the differences between using chopsticks and forks to eat your food, and there are comparable traditions among non-human animal groups, and that's going to be a really fascinating topic for the future. Another topic is how do non-human animals use tools in combinations, either simultaneously or sequentially? And that's another interesting area for the future. And I also think this issue that Christina pointed to, the relationship between intelligence or cognition on the one hand and tool behavior on the other. That's an endlessly fascinating topic.
Fascinating hour. Thank you, all three of you, so much. Ben Beck, Christina Walkup, Rob Shoemaker, authors of the new revision of Animal Tool Behavior, the Use and Manufacture of Tools by Animals. Thank you, all three, for being with us today.
Thank you, Ben.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our program for today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And remember, podcasts and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks, and we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.